We are officially live. Sorry, yeah, for me, the countdown looked like 30, 26, figure it out. So, yeah, but now it seems that we are here. This is something we've been doing for the last panel discussion chat. The idea being that the classics of Sword and Sorcery, rightly so, get discussed quite a bit, but what is a shame sometimes is that more contemporary stories do not get the same love and attention, and we feel they should. So what we do is once a month, pick a story by an author from the last couple of years. You know, it doesn't have to be the last 5 minutes to be contemporary. And we all read it ahead and come in. And, you know, I kind of guide the discussion with a few questions I toss out. But the basic idea is to just all, like I say, give that love and attention to the contemporary story that we so often do to the works of Leiber and Moorcock and so on and so forth. Welcome to it. This month, we're doing it on the Backer Kit campaign. I have a hard time imagining you're seeing this and not knowing about that, but just in case, we are doing a Backer Kit crowdfund for issues 3 and 4 of New Age Sword and Sorcery, and we're not even halfway through, and we've already broken our first 2 stretch goals, and we double art and international shipping discounts if you're in Canada or outside of the US in general. Hey, there's a discount on shipping. That's nice, huh? And we're only a few hundred shy of our first author pay raise, so if you fancy pledging, please do. Let's help us, you know, get the creators paid as much as possible. So yeah, that's happening. True story. Meanwhile, I have a few guests here. As you can see, we have Valerie, who is the diligent copy editor of New Age Sword and Sorcery and a published author in her own right. We have Kevin Beckett, who's not technically on the panel, but we get to see his lovely face. He is our social media coordinator and the technical support for this whole endeavor. We have Jay Wolf, a friend of the show who shows up on many a panel, published author, and potentially the editor of something in the future, who knows. And we also have Milton Davis, head of NV Media, an accomplished publisher and author, primarily in the sword and soul subgenre of sword and sorcery. He actually was very kind and guested on a panel we did last year, so it's nice to have him back. Okay, so hello, everybody.
Hey.
Hi there. Hi.
And today's story that we're discussing is my personal favorite from this collection, came out a couple of years ago, The Oban Axe by Kirk A. Johnson. It's 4 novelette length stories, so, you know, 12,000 ish or longer. And the story is called Cock and Bull. I guess start because I'm going to ask everybody else for their sort of first reactions. But for me, I chose this story in part because I wanted to show off one of our authors, since Kirk is going to be in issue 4 of New Age Sword and Sorcery. And actually, his is the cover story. So you can see the protagonists of this story in that cover art we currently have on the campaign page, because we're having another story with these characters. So it made sense to me to discuss this one. But also because I just find Cock and Bull really fun and really funny at parts. It also embodies something that I really love in Sword and Sorcery, where there are parts where I feel like it really hits on the whole, what I've said many times in other interviews and things like this, that I think Sword and Sorcery is very much a genre rooted in the body. We'll get more into that later. And it's also just like a martial arts duo kind of adventure thing, and I really dig that. Starting with Valerie, and then Jay, and then Milton, why don't you each give us kind of your first reactions to the story?
Yeah, no, I love this story a lot. A kind of story that I like, and so I guess are we going to get spoilerific as we talk about this? Because I don't.
Oh yeah, sorry. Heads up, if you're watching this, we can't discuss this meaningfully without spoilers of the yin yang. But I will say, if you have not read the story and are more into execution than reveals, I think you could still listen to this and then get a kick out of the story and go back through and see, like, oh, do I agree with that? I've already said, what about Milton? I don't know. So I don't know. I'm the guy who, like, unless it's like a Fight Club kind of reveal, I really don't care. I'll spoilers before the thing and then read the story. So if you're like me, go for it. If you really hate spoilers, stop now and watch the recording later. Anyway, sorry, Valerie, go ahead.
No worries. I just wanted to be sure up front. What I love about this story is that it does fall into sort of an omniscient perspective. It definitely what we would call head hopping, which is something that is often frowned upon in a contemporary fantasy literature, but it does it so well. And I think what is fun about it is that despite all of the head hopping, it still has sort of a twist, right? And it comes to a point where you realize that, aha, there is indeed a plan that is going on here, and it involves the different characters that were introduced previously who are being presented in a particular way, but ultimately they are not what they are. And when that reveal fully culminates, it's just a hilarious moment that you're talking about the humor of it. I think that it is just great to, like, I visualize it, right? Like a movie. And I think that's hilarious. I love that about this, that it has that sense of humor and that it does maintain a sort of omniscient perspective while nonetheless tricking the reader into, you know, it obfuscates what happens until it happens. So.
All right, Jay, what was your sort of first impressions of this?
My first impressions on this were just that I really dug the prose. It's very crunchy and detailed in a way that I wasn't expecting. It's like very evocative in a lot of different ways. I'm with Valerie on the usage of like a lack of point of view, for want of a better way to put it. Like, not quite omniscient, and like, I don't know that it was as head hoppy for me per se. Like, I'm kind of used to that sort of writing, but for this particular story, I feel like it worked really well because of, again, what she mentioned, like the reveals. The character design I thought was kind of interesting. I had like, I wrote down on one of my post-it notes, like big Goku energy. Because like, I really like the way that this story plays with power and skill and strength. I thought that all of the fight scenes were just like really bonkers in a very anime way, and I'm like, that's an extremely favorable like, you don't usually see that kind of storytelling mixed with anything that even crosses into sword and sorcery or sword and soul, so to speak. Like, I felt like that really, It was unexpected to me, but it felt right. So I just kind of like leaned into it and kept going. I agree with you also about how like the bodily nature of this story is very like undeniable. I think that's about everything I have on like the very first pass.
All right. How about you, Milton? I mean, I know this is your reread, as I recall, from our chat over Messenger. But, you know, how much do you remember from the previous, you know, the very first read, and then maybe your reread? What's your kind of like first up take?
Well, the thing I like about the story is that, you know, being a sword and soul writer, normally the stories that you run into are more of a, have somewhat of a good and evil type tone to it and stuff like that. And I like the fact that this story, to me, all the characters seem to be like amoral. It was gritty. It was, you know, rough. And again, the humor was there as well. But at the same time, I like the way that Kurt was able to incorporate some of the things that you see in Sword and Soul, which basically this is African-based culture. And the words that he used, the terms that he used, the kingdoms and everything, the way that he established was very like rooted in the Sword and Soul and genre and stuff. So, and I had the opportunity to publish him years ago. He had a story in the Griot's anthology. And so I've been waiting for him to come out with something like this, you know. So when the book came out, I jumped on it, and I wasn't disappointed. Also, like he goes into the I guess you say he gets into more of the the Cthulhu type thing, where he gets into the spirits and that type of thing, and near the end of the book, the climax of it. You get that feeling of it as well. So it's a really good mix to me, and it adds some freshness to the genre to me.
Yeah, I agree. I really think it hits a lot of the classics of, you know, sword and sorcery. We've got a whole bunch of outsiders all circling each other. We're not spending time with upstanding, you know, citizens. There's no knights or kings or whatever. And mm-hmm. as you say, there's definitely some Lovecraftian horror on the back end that, like, I have a whole question about that part that I look forward to us discussing, because that's... There's a lot in the story that made me want to talk about it and makes me like think about it again every once in a while, and I'm just like staring out a window, and that's part of it for sure. But first, I've given away up front. Like, the story seems at first to follow just like one guy, N'Gara, and then we first know him by the nickname Clean, and before that he's even kind of nameless for a little bit, right? So that's kind of fun. You kind of get this like unfurling of like name and identity with him, as well as with the other, you know, nameless old man who then is always called Patches, and then eventually, oh, he's Lovin, and he's N'Gara's, you know, partner in this whole endeavor. I checked last night, the reveal comes pretty deep into the story. It's about three quarters in, almost exactly, going by the page count. How, let's keep going around the merry-go-round here. Valerie, how did you feel about the reveal? Like, when you first read it, did it shock you? Was it funny? Was it sort of like, oh, holy crap? Because I remember I really liked it. I was genuinely surprised by it. But then it also kind of made me revisit some of the brawls between the two of them and thought, like, wow, they went hard at each other for guys that are ostensibly on the same team. What does it say about their relationship, you know? So Valerie, how did you feel about the reveal?
Yes. Kind of thing. So I'm a very metafictive reader, fortunately or unfortunately, and so I was waiting for that shooter drop actually the entire time, especially given that we have that immediate like patience at the beginning, and I think he also drops a line at some point about how his mentor has elaborate plotting, and he's like, I think I would have come up with a simpler plan than this, but okay. And so it did feel, because of that foreshadowing, that this was all part of a master plan, and it was going according to plan even until everything kind of played out. And so, but that was delightful though to me, because then it was not a question of like, okay, yes, there's going to be something's going to happen, that shoe was going to drop, but then I kept waiting to find out how the shoe was going to drop, and the journey to get there was so fun that I was definitely enjoying the process along the way, and none of the things that happened themselves were predictable in any way. So it wasn't even like, oh, I knew what was going to happen the whole time. It was more just I understood there was a particular story shape that this was moving towards, and I was enjoying getting there. And then when it did happen, the way that it played out with them just eating the nut by a tree, I'm just like, this is hilarious. Honestly, I loved it. I loved how it happened, and then what comes after was totally surprising, I think, which made it even better.
Yeah, I really think it's a story that underlines, like, it's not the idea, it's the execution. And so it's very upfront, like, look, we're gonna pull something out from under the rug here, but like, whatever, like, just stay along with this and see what that is and how we do it. Jay, how about you? How did the surprise work for you? Did you have any thoughts while you were all on the way? Did you figure it out before the rest of us?
I mean, I'm in the same boat as Valerie. We both have been reading short fiction for a really long time. And I mean, at this point, I've read literally thousands of stories just for the purposes of slush reading. So I have that sort of like, I have a lot of cues that I look for in stories. And so this one was definitely where I knew something was going to happen. Like, there was too much information about both of these dudes for them not to be linked to each other intrinsically. the way in which that actually came about, and the way that really, like, again, what I found surprising was actually like more in the resolution of the story, like the very like surreal turn. Like right at the point where we're getting all of this information kind of like confirmed, the story wants to pivot and like take you down a whole other avenue in this place. And I really enjoyed that a lot, actually. Like, that when you've read as many like stories in this, in like not necessarily this milieu, but just sort of like in any milieu where like surprise is an innate part of the thing, like it's less of it, like it's the execution thing, like we were talking about, like, and I feel like he nailed it as far as that goes, because I was like, the anticipation made me keep reading at a like very quick pace. The first time I read through the story, just like, all right, I know that something's going to happen. I want to know when it's going to happen and how it's going to happen. And he still managed to make it really surprising, which I thought was nice.
Well, how about you, Melton? Because, I mean, you haven't read Slush for Uncanny, but, like, you are a publisher, you know, you've read a lot of submissions. Yeah. How did that whole surprise thing play out for you?
Yeah, I've done a few anthologies, about 10 or 11. But yeah. But to me, I always take kind of a relaxed approach when I read stories. I knew from the beginning, it was told that he was there. He was an assassin. He was there to kill somebody. So to me, it was kind of like watching a mystery, you know, when the detective comes in, you know, somebody committed the murder, but it's a matter of trying to figure out who actually did it. And that's what I was looking at the entire time. Every time he introduced a character, I was like, okay, so who is he exactly here to kill? Is it this person? Or is it that person? But I didn't try to get ahead of the story. I just said I would sit there and just let it go and see where it was going. And it was kind of a nice surprise when you found out that, you know, his antagonist or his nemesis was, you know, basically the person he's hanging out with. But the last part did kind of catch me. I'm like, when they went to the whole, when we got into the Lovecraftian part, that was I wasn't expecting that. That was kind of like a bonus round. So, you know, so you know, you're like, okay, now this is done. Everybody goes home. But wait, there's more.
That's a really good way of putting it. Like that's how that hits for sure.
Yeah. So
yeah, the second more impactful ending. Yeah.
It was fun. I mean, I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the descriptions as well, because again, like, you know, knowing being familiar with some of the historical references of where Kirk, you know, takes his story from, it was nice to see how he described those particular influences and the words that he used to substitute for the ones you would probably find, you know, in the historical background. So that was fun right there.
Well, you know, something Jay said, actually, I've been sitting on, because I think it could be interesting for all four of us to touch upon, was, Jay, you know, you said, well, you know, this other guy had so much detail given in his description and everything else. I knew he was important. And 1,000 role-playing game sessions just flashed before my eyes where, mm-hmm. you know, as the game master, you try and, like, be like, okay, the villain's going to show up here, but, you know, they'll be hiding in the shadows for an hour. They'll be pretending to be the local beggar. Or whatever, and then the players are like, you told me exactly what this guy's clothes look like, he's plainly important, I go up and put my sword to his throat, or whatever. You know, people end up metagaming, or at least, like, it's hard, or they try not to, but there's still that internal tension of, like, we know this guy's eye color. Plainly this is important. So in terms of, like, you know, writing a story, which is, I mean, yeah, similar, how do you all, because I mean, all your published authors, how do you approach that when you want to pull a reveal something along the lines of what Kirk's done here, or just in general, you're like, okay, well, I want this character to be important in a scene foreshadowed. I don't want them to come out of nowhere, but, like, I also don't want them to be like, you know, hey, they got the eye color and their DNA, you know, helix described to me, so shit, I gave it away. I'll reverse the rotation here, and I'll make you talk again, Milton. Like, when you've been trying to play with a similar kind of tool, you know, surprise situation here as Kirk did, what's your approach?
Well, for me, I think, you know, foreshadowing has something to do with that, you know, because when the reader looks back, you don't want it to be like a red herring situation. You want to look back and say, oh, yeah, this happened here and this was there. And, you know, and then you finally find out, you know, you can put it together. You can look back and put it together and see the path where you couldn't necessarily see it before. It was obvious if you were paying attention. But the way you do it is you mention it nonchalantly. You know, you make a reference to it, but you don't make it a focus of a paragraph or a sentence or something like that. It's just something that's stated and it's there, but, you know, you don't see the importance of it till that later on the reveal. And I think what the way Kirk does it is, it's like all the players are there. And what throws you off so much is, like you say, the way that him and Patches are going so hard at each other. You know, I mean, they're like, you know, when they get together, they're like after each other. But I think the thing that kind of got me thinking a little bit about there being more to Patches, and I think everybody saw it, was when he, you know, and I can't spoilers, when he broke out of prison, you know.
And yeah,
because, like, this is just not a guy that he met in a club and met in a tavern and they got into a fight. There's something else to this guy, you know, that kind of like that. So when you finally find out who he is, it's surprising in a way. But then when you look back at the things he did prior to that, it kind of makes sense, you know.
I think that's also the first element of the supernatural that shows up in the story, unless I'm mistaken, where he has that sort of, like, that gum. And then, you know, not only does he become stronger for a moment, what I love, what made it interesting to me, if he just got strong and, like, pulled the bars open, I'd be kind of like, all right, he had gum of +3 strength, who cares? But then I love how, like, the follow through on that is then his body, like, goes, like, kind of breaks and stretches out to, like, go through the hole he's made.
Yeah, but
that was very charming. Suggested a kind of ugly weirdness that is what I personally want in my sorcery and supernatural strangeness, you know, in this genre. You know, it's got to be a little bit of ugly weirdness to it.
And then he was conscientious enough to put the bars back in place.
Yeah. You don't want to be rude, you know? No, that was pleasing. How about you, Jay? I mean, you know, you say, but, you know, having read an uncanny amount of submissions, one could say, you know, do you find that makes you maybe even second guess yourself a little bit when you're writing? Kind of like, well, I'll try this. Ah, crap, I've seen it 32,000 times. Like, you know, when you're trying to lay up a surprise along the lines of what Kirk's done here.
That is actually a huge problem that I have, is that I have read a lot of stuff just in general. I mean, I read like crazy when I'm not reading Slush. When I am reading Slush, it's a whole other animal. But yeah, so, like, One of the things that I like to do is sort of, I like to leave what I call thread when I'm writing. So what I do is I will leave out little things that I don't necessarily even know. I don't even know where they go sometimes. And then when I need something, I have thread I can pull on and pull that into the next story that I'm working on. And so that's something that I look for other people to do as well, which is why, again, like Valerie was saying, like the like we knew to anticipate something, but we were still pulling that thread the whole way along. Like, all right, something's going to be on the end of this thread. And I feel like, again, that was just that was built really well. I liked also just like the scenic detail was like really good. And I feel like he hid a lot of stuff in just like there's all kinds of places that you could hide little details. And I think he did a really good job of that.
Was there any one detail that springs out when you think about that? You made me think of the vase and the bar at the beginning. But,
yes, that was.
Yeah, it was a good bit of world building. The bartender is one sign of like him having had a life anywhere outside this goddamn bar, and it finally gets broken and just like.
Yeah, and it suggests. Yeah. I mean, it suggests this whole other story that, like, of course you're not going to get, but it's right there. Like that story is right there, and it's on the floor, and it's smashed, and it's ruined.
Yeah, I mean that's some of my favorite kind of world building. You know, I was on a BookTube interview Friday night, and world building came up, and the way it tends to come up in like. I think a lot of contemporary fantasy of just like, you know, writing the RPG splat book of the universe or whatever. And I was like, well, in Sword and Sorcery, in my opinion, you know, much more along these lines, I think. You much more want to have just inference and little details woven through to like help get you engaged with the story by making you do the old, you know, thing of like, you know, you don't see the woman getting stabbed in the shower, you just see the silhouette, so your imagination gets rolling. That whole thing. You know, I just think personally, I think that's better. and I think it's good because, by engaging your imagination, it draws you in rather than laying it all out for you and keeping you at kind of a remove, like you're just floating above the map, looking at, you know, Google Maps or whatever. Kirk does an excellent job of that throughout the story. And there were several items where I was like, I don't need to read that story. I don't need to watch the, you know, solo film, you know, or whatever that goes with that vase.
Yeah, it's just that it exists.
Fun to, like, yeah. For me.
It's just that it exists in that world.
Yeah. It's fun to have it like flicking through my head briefly. Yeah. Valerie, how about you? You know, how do you approach these kinds of surprises, you know, crafting them in your own fiction?
So many, 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 many years ago, I took a TV writing class with a really smart guy. And the thing that he told us, this was like, I feel like this was the height of like Shyamalanism happening. And everyone was trying to reproduce that kind of effect in their work. And he was like, listen, if you're going to have something that is a twist, it either has to be such a twist that it's impossible to see coming. Nobody's going to see it coming. Or you accept that, you know, like the 1% of people are going to see it coming and this isn't for them. That's fine. Or just use dramatic irony. Instead of making it a twist, show the thing. Let the reader be in on it the entire time, such that the experience of it is not waiting for there to be a twist. It's not, oh my gosh, there was a twist and I didn't see it coming. It's like this story, when is the shoe going to drop? Mm-hmm. And because of those hints in the beginning, because of those threads like Gio's talking about that are left there for us to find, even though we are expecting something to happen the entire time, that suspense is carrying us through, that sense of sort of dramatic irony, that anticipation that we know a thing is going to happen. And so it's not that, you know, we are shocked and, you know, surprised by a twist that came out of absolutely nowhere. No, it's that we knew something was going to happen and that anticipation really carried us through. And so that's something that I more and more tend to do is instead of trying to aim at a twist, instead of trying for absolute surprise, I go for dramatic irony. I let the reader in on the thing immediately. Hitchcock said that, you know, how long would he have an on-screen kiss? And he was like, oh, like 3 minutes. And the person was like, 3 minutes? That's a long kiss. And he's like, yeah, but I'd put a bomb under the seat first. And it's kind of, that's what this story does too. There's a bomb under the seat. And we're just waiting to find out where is it going to go off? When is it going to go off? We saw the bomb get put there more or less. And we, because it is sort of, switching perspectives a little bit throughout and following the different characters, you know, we do get to see what they're all doing and we're just waiting to see how it all culminates. And I think that's great.
Yeah, no, I really agree with that. It's like kind of like, as a reader, I feel I'd rather feel in on it and then be like, yeah, the thing happened. I was, you know, when it happens, then feel on the outside and be like, oh, that was the big surprise, you know. Because I think when you're kept on the outside, so to speak, of the surprise, it's kind of like, it makes me think of an old interview I saw with Jerry Seinfeld, where he was really mad at someone early in his career, who just before he got on stage, this someone was introducing him, and he was already pretty popular. So this person introducing him said, you know, and here's Jerry Seinfeld, the funniest man in the world. And Jerry Seinfeld hated the guy immediately, because of course with that introduction, he got on stage and the whole audience was like, oh, really? And was very reluctant to laugh, because they had had that, you know, distance pushed between them. Like, oh, the funniest guy in the world. And it's similar when a story is like, you're never going to believe this shit, and just like keeps you on the outside of it. Well, yeah, it better be pretty goddamn amazing. Otherwise, you're just going to be sitting there waiting to like pick a hole in it. Right. So, yeah, I think, you know, the route you just described is ever much the wiser one. Better let the reader in on it, kind of thing. Okay, so I'm going to shift a little bit to discussing language in two sort of small, I imagine, relatively swift ways. One of them is I did laugh, and then I kind of paused and I'm like, early in the story, when the phrase swamp ass gets used, as we're having it described to us, just how unclean, the ironically nicknamed Clean, later revealed to be Nagara, is. And there's a couple other moments like that in the story, pretty much all cursing, you know, calling someone like a shit-encrusted chill or whatever. And it's just like things that kind of felt like they don't have to be modern. It's not like they were talking about iPhones, but it does feel like a little more modern vernacular. And I guess I'm curious to get your thoughts. Like, you know, sometimes I like it. Like, it made me laugh in the story. I don't remember it being putting me off. And then other fantasy stories, I won't name names, but some authors like just kick me right out of the story when they use modern vernacular, including cursing. And yet I'll say that, and then you'll also find me, you know, smash cut to me in some other conversation, hating on like made up swear words and being like, it's so dumb, just say fuck, you know? So I just want to take the temperature, I guess, go around the room here. Milton, like how did you feel when you encountered these kind of like more almost modern colloquial curses and so on in the story? And how is your feeling in general about like, I guess curse words, but also just inventing language versus using more modern terms, you know, referring to something as technology or whatever, for example, in the, you know, fantasy story. What's your feeling on that? How do you react?
Again, I'm kind of real laid back about stories. I'm going to accept the world that you give me. And if the world that you give me includes, you know, what we call modern curse words, then I'm going to go with that. I mean, I don't get thrown out of the story. I'm really there for the essence of the story. The way that the nicknames were given in the story kind of resonated with me, because I almost think it's a cultural thing, because when I was growing up, especially when I was in college, you gave a person a nickname that was something that was about them. And sometimes it was something that would normally be insulting about them. but they accepted, like when the guy smelled bad and they called him Clean, and the other guy had an eye, you know, they called him Patches and stuff like that. We used to do that in real life, you know. So that was really humorous to me, because I was like, okay, yeah, we used to do that all the time growing up and stuff like that. At the same time, you know, I don't, when I write my stories, I kind of develop the curses or whatever like that in relation to the world that I've built. You know, whatever the gods and the spirits or the culture that I've built, I try to, you know, develop slang and curse words that are built around that. But again, there are a couple of stories that I read back when there were a few people who didn't know that there was actually black people who had already written Sword and Soul and said they were going to be writing it for the first time. And there was one particular story where the vernacular was so modern that it did throw me out of the story, that I just couldn't get into it, because it was just such a difference between the speech pattern of the people and the world that they had created. Mm-hmm. But in the case of Kurt's story, it felt natural, because I kind of felt like it was part of what he was doing, especially when he just started off right at the point and said, you know, swamp ass, you know, now, okay, so I'm okay. Now I know where I am. I know what we're going to be working with. You know, and even the people who, the way they carried themselves, the anti-heroes, the down and dirty type people, it fit. For me, it fit in this story. So I really didn't have a problem with it.
Okay, so would you say with that story that did throw you out, would you say it was just like the volume, like the amount of vernacular language? Is it maybe kind of using it sparingly? And in this case, we're talking about crudities and we're dealing with crude people, so it fits. Like,
well, when the story, which I will not name, yeah. I think I would have accepted it better if it had been like a post-apocalyptic world that had degraded to, say, a former state where you had people with a sword and soul type or sword and sorcery type world, but it had been something previous. But when you present it as if this was like the past, but you're using this very modern language and vernacular in it, then that just throws me off. And that's, I think, what was wrong with the other story, because it had created this scenario that you thought you were like in a past type setting, but then the language and everything that people were saying was like very modern and contemporary. And that's what kind of threw me. I think Kurt had the right balance, had a nice balance of having a little bit, because he didn't do it a lot, but he had a little bit of it in there. But at the same time, it felt like it fit the world and it fit the people and the situation that he presented to us.
Yeah, and I also like just Swamp Ass helps bring the tone in, you know, the humor that, like we say, like, you know, pops its head up here and there throughout the tale. How about you, Jay? How's your? Oh, sorry, Milton, go on.
Well, no, go ahead.
I was just gonna toss over to Jay, but if you're still talking.
No, I'm good.
All right, so yeah, Jay. I mean, how was your reaction to that, and how is your feeling? Maybe again, like, you know, from the slush mines, what's your experience there? Like, because I'll just throw one in thing in more before I let you answer, which is. It occurs to me, the other thing, of course, is when people go so far into trying to artificially create archaic fantasy talk that you just, you know, I enjoy a good by Odin's balls or whatever, you know, as much as the next person. But sometimes that can get kind of like overly, you know, overly forced or whatever. So, you know, what's the balance here, right? Between more contemporary stuff and then trying to fashion the oldie phrases. But yeah, anyway. So yeah, Jay, what's
your impression? That's a good point. I'm actually I'm very persnickety about those kind of things. I want like one by Odin's balls max per story. I really like, that's the kind of thing that's actually going to throw me off way more than like super contemporary stuff. I view language as world building. I view language choice as world building. And so for me, I'm less concerned about what the specific choice of words is so much as what they're painting. And so, like, I felt like this story had a voice immediately. And I think that actually, like, basically in this story, like, Swamp Ass is the exact point where, like, either you are all in or you're, like, all out. And for me, it was all in because I was like, yes, all right, I needed to see where this is going. I don't think that the language was, like, intrusively any particular vibe. Like, it was all in service to like a really specific setting and a really specific set of characters. And I feel like it was handled really well in that sense. Like I didn't think of it never like distracted me from the story the way that like someone in this story would be really, really off-putting if they were like, oh, by Odin's balls, ah, blah, blah. Like that type of like very fifth edition kind of shit would not really have flown in this story. I think that it would be like a disservice to this kind of story to try and insert that kind of thing. Like that would be very intrusive in this space. Whereas like, I felt like I could tell so much about these characters by how they talk and how they talk to each other. Like it was great. That was the interactions, the dialogue, like none of it was like, I feel like it was on a level with the reader also. Like you never felt like you were being like talked down to or like you were allowed a lens into this world, and like that lens is through the linguistic choices of the story. I really liked it. I did a lot of Googling because some of the terminology is not normal to me, but I actually like I welcome those kind of things in stories. Like that's kind of my like, oh, this sounds interesting. I need to find out more about it. But yeah, like for me, that was really where the vernacular worked for me really well, actually. Like I don't think that the modernness was any issue, I guess.
Oh, right on. And how about you, Valerie? I mean, maybe we've already kind of covered this pretty thoroughly, but I was curious, like, you know, were you all in on Swamp Ass or you know, how did that all work for you?
I just would like to acknowledge that we've said the words Swamp Ass so many times in this particular discussion.
Yeah.
And I think that's great.
No. What we'll do, Kevin, I'll ask you to edit a supercut for us later of just
Swamp Ass. How many times does Swamp? Yeah, Swamp Ass over and over again. What I think was great though was that first of all, it established its own immediately, but second of all, it really paid off because of the fact that then it kept being brought up over and over again. It was something that could have easily been a throwaway line, but was not. It was actually a very vital character trait, and then it was literally the ending. Them washing their asses. I was just like, this is so good. This is so good.
Bookend it tied together perfectly. Really well.
Yeah, no notes. I loved it. And you forgot that it ended with them cleaning
I did when I was rereading it. I forgot that like two big, sweet, dirty cheeks, one on either side of the story, it just bookends it perfectly.
There was the point. No, it's okay. Where it's like, oh no, we're gonna take you to a place where you can wash. And he's like, well, what is the thing? And it's like, you smell like a toilet. She said you smell like a toilet. So it isn't even that Swamp Ass is something used by everyone involved in the story. It is a particular phrase for that person who used it initially, and then other people characterize it in different ways throughout. World building. Exactly.
Yeah. I've got the word here. He smells like a wanag. And I remember as I read that line the first time. I was kind of like, oh, what? Like, is that some sort of weird animal? And then two lines down, oh, okay, thanks. Like, clarifies for me and the character.
You knew whatever a one egg smelled like, it wasn't good.
It was
this is funny because it's a fantasy story, and I'm so used to fantasy stories being like, the smearp or whatever. That when I first read One Egg, I imagined some, I don't know, weird hairless lion or something that had a big butt. I don't know, whatever. And like I said, two lines down, boom, it tells you, it means a toilet. And I was like,
it was great. It was perfect. Like, perfect comedic timing for that, though, too, because it was like, that was the punctuation on that joke. But bringing up Smearp, though, like, I think that is a great thing about this story is that, and that's something that can go through readings of, like, various fantasy stories, is that question of when are we going to use Smearp? When are we just going to use Rabbit? When are we going to invent a word for a thing? When are we going to use an accessible word that people are going to recognize? When are we going to treat this as something where there are like just a ton of conlang occurring throughout the story versus that sort of this is being implicitly translated into English that we can all read sort of thing instead. And I think that this story does a great job of balancing it. That question of like, which words are we going to use that are common, accessible English words? Which words are we going to use that are like appropriate to the setting and chosen for those reasons and appropriate to the characters and chosen for those reasons? I like to throw out when my story is empanada a lot instead of like hand pie or meat pie or something like that, because I'm like, no, I'm picturing a very particular thing. And so even if in theory that world element doesn't exist and there's no Spain or Spanish culture or anything like that, it still is a word that I will reach for that reason. And I think this story does a lot of that too in very good ways.
Yeah, and actually, thank you, because you sort of you bridged over into the other half of my like little two-part language question thing, which was, I was going to talk also about like, the sort of fantasy African language, which, Milton, as a sort of sole publisher, I don't feel it's too wacky to ask you. Like, I personally am not super familiar, I imagine, with like what Kirk was drawing upon for this, but did you recognize any terms, or was it more like fantasy made-up stuff that sounded African, or were there like, was he kind of riffing off of things like the same way Saunders riffed off the Maasai? Like, how did you pick up anything that maybe the rest of us might have missed?
Well, there's so many cultures that you can refer to in Africa, so many different languages that you can refer to that, to me, most of the words that he was using were words that I weren't familiar with. However, the use of the words gave me a reference point to what he was describing, say, in particular African cultures. I get a feeling that the story took place in an area that would be similar to the Sahel in Africa, the grassland between the Sahara and the forest and stuff, because some of the way he described the cities and the towns and the fact that the people were familiar with the desert and stuff like that, put me in the place of where of what this place would look like, what this country would look like, this land would look like. And like I said, the way he used the words in context, and that's, to me, is very important. You don't necessarily have to know what a word means as long as you can pull the definition from the context in which it was used. When I wrote Changa Safar, I used a lot of Swahili, and I didn't tell you what the words meant. I just used it. But in most cases, when you read the story, you can have an ideal, you have an ideal of what the words meant, and you can look them up and find out if you want to know more specific. And I think Kirk did the same thing. You know, he created different words for familiar situations. If you're familiar in that part of Africa and stuff like that. So, I take whatever you give me when I read a story, you know, as long as I can understand what it means in context and you put it in a way where nobody has to just stop and give you a definition or there's some quotation marks there to tell you what it means, because that's distracting, you know? So, and I think he did a very good job of using those new words in a context, in context that we can understand them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because if I remember correctly, in fact, why don't I just look right now? Kirk does have a glossary at the back, but it's not too long. And it's the kind of thing that, like, it's fun to check out if you want to, but I never felt like, what the hell's happening? Jesus, I don't know. I'll check the glossary. Like, you never get that feeling in Kirk's stuff. As you say, there's plenty of context. And, you know, if you're really dying for it, you can go back and check the stuff, but like, mm-hmm. confirm. Oh, yeah, okay. That is what I thought it meant. And I really prefer that. I know it's kind of an easy target in fantasy fiction to be like, oh, you know, I this phone book size thing with a 300 page glossary, blah, blah, blah. But honestly, like anything that takes me away from the story, like sometimes literally physically within the tome, I find is not my favorite move. So yeah, Kirk does a good job with that here with the context. Okay, so something else I want to ask y'all about. It is not unknown, and I'm not calling out any specific authors I've worked with. I've given this note enough times. Oftentimes when I'm giving someone feedback on fight scenes, I'll make kind of a joking, not joking remark about how to say, well, you know, they say fight scenes are kind of like love scenes. You know, either way, you want to focus more on the emotion than the IKEA assembly manual, you know, and then this goes here, then that went there, and that punched that, and you know, that kissed there. But this story has a lot of detail in the fights. And this is one of those things where, like, if you just, like, told me, I might be like, oh, okay, that sounds like maybe they kind of, I don't know. But then I read it, and I loved it. And Kirk has a great, you know, I think bring up Dragon Ball, bring up anime fight scenes, like that is genuinely a good descriptor and a good compliment, because it never feels like I think the problem often when you get that, you know, IKEA assembly manual fight scene description is that, as my descriptor for it suggests, it is slow and plodding, and you're just kind of like da 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 da. But I never got that feeling here. I always got that sense of kind of momentum, and again, the humor, right? I mean, Valerie, you mentioned on the back end when the mob boss gets fighting with her seeming subordinate, who turns out to be, you know, a scheming distant ancestor of an evil giant, you know, when that fight's going on, the two fellows are sitting back and they're like, yeah, you know, just being like Statler or Waldorf almost for the fight scene, you know, chewing on cola nuts. And then Nagara says, I sent some of the effect of Lemon says, like, yeah, she's pretty good. And Nagara's like, yeah, but still. And then Quip flings his half of a nut that he's not finished so that it goes under the big guy's feet and makes him fall. And then, like, okay, now they're into the fight and interfering. And the action kind of like rolls from that. Yeah, like I was down. I found myself craving that level of detail, which is unusual for me. So yeah, I'll say one more thing and then I'm going to toss it to you guys. I know from speaking with him many times, either in the interview I did on someone writing a novel or just chatting, whatever, outside of that, Kirk really loves and grew up on like exploitation films, and I gotta imagine like there were some kung fu movies in the mix, you know, from the 70s and 80s. I also wonder, I've never asked him about this, and I guess I'm wondering if this has been present in the reading of any of you three. I feel like there had to be. I feel like I've seen covers. I should have looked this up before we started. What can I say? But I feel like there had to have been like some 70s like kung fu exploitation novels. Right, like little short paperbacks, you know, kind of thing, like riffing off the Bruce Lee phenomenon. I just wonder if any of you ever tripped over those. And regardless, you know, let's start with you, Valerie. How did you feel about the fight scenes? It sounds like they definitely worked for you as well. What do you think saves them from the IKEA assembly manual? And what was something that you really dug about them?
Okay, well, bad news. I'm the person that likes reading those. So I'm not even the person to ask that question of. I'm the person that's like, yes, okay. Give me the choreography. I want to read it. I did fight choreography a million years ago. I did HEMA. Like, I am the person that is the target audience for, yes, I want the blow-by-blow. I want the play-by-play. But I think that this does a great job maneuvering between the sort of nitty-gritty details and the more, like, zoom the camera back a little and see the entirety of the thing happening. And then the very tiny motions like that, oh, you know, flicking the nut under the heel, like it navigates between very specific detail and general sort of landscape emotion. Very easily, very well. And I think that that versatility is what makes the fights very good. You still have a sense from start to finish in the fight that there is a forward motion in it, that it is working towards something. And I think that also carries it forward, each of the different fights. They all have a sense of purpose and a sense that it's going to mean something ultimately. And they do, I think. And the revelations in the final fight were just delightful. It was just a series of, like, because of the fact that our initial characters have come into the city, they're in disguise, they have an ulterior motive and a different purpose, to then have this entire story just be a series of revealed ulterior motives and, like, people tearing masks off, so to speak. I think it was great how that worked out. But that fight scene in particular, like you said, it's just the two of them watching it go down. I think also because they're sort of the viewpoint characters there, it allows for a more specificity of detail because they're observing it, they're watching it, and they're commenting on it. And I think just the ways in which this is told work very well to make the thing function cohesively.
Yeah, I think you're very right. The forward momentum and the fact that each fight is doing more than being a fight, it never feels like, you know, well, we got to have a fight scene here. You know, I mean, the earlier fights between Patches and Clean, as they're called at the time, they're bamboozling you along with the other characters, right? So like, that's kind of cool. So yeah, it always serves a purpose. How about you, Jay? How did you feel about the fights, and did they escape the blow-by-blow slowdown for you, or what was your take on the action in our sort of martial arts sword and soul Favre Grey Mouser tale here?
Yeah, actually, I mean, I really thought that there was a good balance of those types of things. I never felt like really bogged down in details I didn't need. I felt like he didn't really dwell on any one element for too long, and there were always, like, again, it was that thing where I was always sort of looking for like little pieces of stuff going on, because like you have the sort of like background of like what's going on in the cafe in that first fight, like, or like, I guess, tavern cafe type space. Like, there's this whole other side conversation with these two other people, and like just like all of those little things stitch into the fight too, and then like it follows them outside. Like, it just was really neat. And then like as the story goes on, I never felt like any one fight scene was really like outrageous in that regard. I would say, like, in terms of like pulp stuff, like there has to be something, but it's not something I've crossed a lot of paths with. I feel like, especially with like I would say that it probably exists, but it's probably not in the like science fiction fantasy space. It's probably a little bit more in the like mystery thriller space, which is one that I'm just not at all versed in. In terms of the actual, I lost my train of thought there. In any case, yes, I thought the fight scenes were fantastic. I thought they did a really good job of pulling the reader through the story. I didn't feel like any of it was not moving forward.
Yeah, because I think it's a real common pitfall with sword and sorcery, because people are like, well, you got to open with a fight scene. But then it's like, well, you don't care about what's happening because you don't know anybody yet. Or, okay, well, we get to a point where like there could be a fight scene. There doesn't have to be, but they jam one in because, well, we're deep in the second act. We got to break into the third with like a big showdown. Or, you know, yeah, like none of it felt perfunctory. All of it, as you say, pulled the story forward. It's quite pleasing. Kevin's letting us know there were several men's adventure novels and series that riffed on modern day kung fu movies of the 70s. I thought there had to be. And there was an 8-book series, Black Samurai, by Mark Olden. Okay, that's cool.
Men's adventure. That's a good tag for that genre.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny too, because a part of me would definitely publish men's adventure, but I'd want to, like, I don't know, change what it was called to be more inclusive. I know what you do there. We'll figure it out later. Milton, how did you feel about the action? You know, again, you're a publisher. You've certainly read your fair share of submitted fight scenes that probably didn't work for you. You know, why did this work here, assuming it did? And what are some maybe common pitfalls in fight scenes that you run into?
Well, I'm a former martial artist. I say former because I don't practice anymore. So, you know, but at the time I was practicing, cool. I practiced a number of different martial arts. And so I can always tell when I'm reading something, whether that the person that's writing it either is also a martial artist or they really study fights, you know. And so I'm reading this and I'm looking at the details, not only the details of the fight, but not about not just where the punches are being thrown, but where they're landing.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that a person that is skilled in fighting the martial arts and knows that if a person hits a person at a certain place or something like that, like especially in the end, near the end where I can't remember the character slices the sorcerer behind his knees to hamstring and stuff like that, you know. And so you're seeing all this stuff and you're like, yeah, you know, yeah, Kurt's out there, you know. Kurt has a little knowledge in this kind of stuff like that. So at the same time, you know, too, when you have a fight, you know, you want to make sure that it's logical, that it's supposed to be there. The first fight in there was to throw up, you know, now when you look at it in hindsight, you can tell that the first fight was in there to throw you off the track that Clean and Patches had anything to do with each other, because they have this big cowboy style fight where they're just tearing the whole place up, so bad, you know, and it established this animosity between, which is one of the reasons why when they finally do come together, it kind of throws you off, because like these guys really can't stand each other. You know, when they fight each other, they fight all out and that kind of thing, you know. So, I hate martial artists who write fight scenes and they're very technical with them, saying like, you know, he threw a spinning back kick and, you know, and landed it to his solar plexus. And then, you know, all this kind of his back fist and stuff, you know, because I always think about this one thing that Bruce Lee said. He said before he learned the martial arts, a punch was just a punch and a kick was just a kick. When he began taking the martial arts, a punch was no longer a punch and a kick was no longer a kick. But once he understood the martial arts, a punch was just a punch and a kick was just a kick. You know? I think people who understand the martial arts, when they write fight scenes, they write it the same way. They know the average person is not going to be one to know that this guy did a double spinning back kick and all this kind of stuff like that. They just want to say he kicked him in the head, he punched him in the gut and things like that. But in a way that it seems, you know, realistic. So I know I'm getting on a tangent, but like I said, I'm a martial artist. So. Yeah. And that's why I enjoy fight scenes so much.
Yeah. No, this is all great insight. I mean, we wanted to hear your thoughts about the fight scene. So, you know, lay it on us. I like that. I did appreciate the level of detail. I mean, once in a while, I'm a sucker for like, and then he deployed the red steel claw punch or whatever. Even though that's usually nonsense, it's kind of fun. You can kind of imagine the screen freezing for a second and like a big color, you know, outline of the whole thing, whatever. But I mean, that's, you know, you don't have to do that. And like, I mean, the way these guys fight, you know, it's interesting. It keeps making me think about the relationship by the time you realize, oh, they're mentor and student. But like, they really beat the holy hell out of each other earlier. And even the teacher's like, you know, you didn't have to hit me that fucking hard, you know, the second time he gets beat up in the alleyway. And he's like, well, I had to sell the story, you know. So it really does make you wonder, like, to what degree did these guys actually get along? And like, why are they stuck together if they, you know? But I mean, at the same time, they're there for each other in the end. And that's what matters. Speaking of the end, we're getting close, so I'm going to get into the last like big discussion question I want to throw to y'all, which I foreshadowed earlier because I'm a genius. No, I'm not. It's what we talked about briefly at the beginning, which was the second ending, so to speak. You know, the story gets to the point where there's potentially, ostensibly, you know, great-great-great-great-great-grandson of some big giant who's now just like an unusually fast-moving big guy perishes. You know, and the woman crime boss is captured, and the two guys are looking at each other, and they're like, well, shouldn't we kill her? Wouldn't that make life easier? And, you know, Laman, the older fella, is like, well, we've actually got something else we really got to do. We're running out of time, so maybe we won't kill her. You know, and he pulls out that freakish little ring thing with, like, a beak in it, feeds it 20 drops of his own blood, and as he's doing it, you know, Kirk embarks upon what I think is a very difficult challenge that I thought he nailed, which is, you know, Even good old H.P. Lovecraft, we've all had a bit of a chuckle at his expense in a few of his stories where he's like, and then there was something so weird. Oh my God, it was so fucking weird. I can't describe it. It was indescribably fucking weird. It was so weird. You just take my word for it, man. And like, sometimes that works, and a lot of time you're like, okay, like, give me one adjective. Here, I mean, Kurt kind of did that, right? Because he describes like the prelude to the weird. I mean, he shows you like the funny little device, ? You know, magical device thing. The lion pulls out and feeds 20 drops of blood. And then as he's doing that, he does the great job of telling you, like, okay, you know, to his buddy and to the woman, you know, if you have to, you know, just scream at the top of your lungs, you got to just, like, completely void your bowels. Like, just do it. Do what you got to do. Whatever you do, do not turn around and look at the thing. And also, I felt this was a key detail, do not run. because I love that detail. Do not run, because whatever this is about to happen will be drawn to you, I guess. And then just chucks it into the house, you know, where the sort of, you know, mystical second tier crime guy who was trying to take over was storing all of his treasures, that is briefly alluded to just casually as being bigger on the inside than the outside, plainly a strange place, sight that is never fully explained to us, thank goodness. And then he just uses his sort of like kung fu move or whatever to like hypnotize all the horses to like go to sleep, which I thought was fun. And I don't know if it's because I've been thinking about Jarella Jarrie a lot lately and that iconic scene in Black God's Kiss, where she has like dozens of white blind horses rushing past her in the black void under the castle. But there was something about that flashed across my mind in this, when the rumbling and the tumbling starts and the three of them turn around and, you know, Lavin's like, whatever you do, he keeps reminding him like, don't look behind you. But you do catch that, like, the horses, even unconscious, their desire to flee is so strong that on their sides they're kicking their legs. I love, 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 love that visual detail. And so, yeah, Kirk, I thought, just did a really good job of selling to me. Like, I felt like the tone is funny and action-packed as it's been up to that point. Does land the hard veering into deep terror by describing the reactions of the three people trying to just weather the change in the air pressure, the feeling of like tentacles, reaching out to, you know, their bodies and kind of almost like just stroking them. But, you know, they know if they do anything wrong, like look over their shoulders and run, they'll agitate them into doing God knows what. You know, and the fact that we've had these like very funny descriptions of swamp ass and like whatever else, and then here we are having descriptions of them voiding themselves, and yet it's not remotely funny. It sells the horror. As much as it sets up the later gag of both of the guys really need to freaking change their pants at the end. So, you know, I think this is like, there's a lot I liked in this story. I think this is the big part of what made me reach out to Kirk and commission a story for last year and then bring it back this year. I was so impressed by how he did like a 90-degree turn on a pin and made it work in terms of tone. He sold the horror without really showing me the thing. Not really. She sort of shows you the setup and the effect it has on the people. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. How about you, Val? How did you feel about, how did that part hit you when you first read it? Sorry, I realize I've kind of described it in a lot of detail already, but, you know, what was your reaction while reading?
No, it's all good. I think that the specificity of detail is actually what I did love about it, is that even though it does have that element of, like, the unknowable still associated with it because of the fact that they're not looking and they're avoiding it, there are still so many very specific sensory details that ground us in the situation. And we're getting also kind of the emotional landscapes of the characters. And again, like the 20 drops of blood, he's describing the thing very specifically. All of that really combines to make it a very visceral experience. You talked previously about the notion of sword and sorcery and sword and souls being of the body. And I felt like this was very of the body. And I think for me, what is fun is that a lot of stories where you have a sort of Chekhov's gun element of, you know, don't turn around. and she starts to turn around and he grabs her face and prevents it. And I was waiting for somebody to turn around to find out what happens to the person who turns around, and nobody turned around.
Pillar of salt moment.
Yeah, I was waiting for the pillar of salt moment, and the fact that it did not happen, I thought was great. That was something that, for me as a reader, me personally, it was a twist, and I loved that about the story. I loved that it didn't happen. I loved that you didn't have that moment of like, oh, you were told not to do the thing, so of course you did the thing. Because then we got to see a much more interesting finale play out in terms of the different groups, you know, going in their separate ways and figuring out what's going to happen from there. And I think that opened things up in a very interesting way. But yeah, like the specificity of the details without getting into the full like gamut of what was going on was, I think, a really perfect way to handle the situation. And I loved it. And I loved the sort of humorous element of them all crapping themselves, because honestly, it was beyond scary. It was a situation that we were prepared for. And that also worked in terms of, he told us, if you need to do this, then do it. And so I'm like, okay, are they actually good? No, they did. They did. It was, yeah. we were told it would happen, and then it happened, and it was funny, and I loved that too.
As it was foretold.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's funny. Something else I was talking about in that BookTube interview that you just reminded me of was a Lord Dunsany tale where, I think I'm messing up the name of them slightly, but it's like something of the Gerblins or the Gerblins or whatever. It sounds like goblins, but like off model. And it's just a story that, long story short, literally opens where the narrator's like, Oh man, the Gerblins, nobody ever beats them. They always beat you. They always catch and eat you. Never goes well. Never works out. Anyway, here's a story about a guy who thought he could rob them. And it goes throughout the whole story. And by the end, the guy's like in the bottom of their tower and he's scooping out emeralds. He's flooded the basements. He's scooping the emeralds in the water into a bag. And then it's like, and then he turned around and he saw in the hole that he knocked in the wall, in the moonlight, the silhouette. And you still don't get a good description of them, right? The Gerblins. And then it's just like cut, smash cuts to him being speared into the side of their tower. Another warning to, you know, people who want to rob from them. And it's like the narrator just turns to you. Like, I told you, man. I told you, fucking Gerblins. Nobody beats them. And I just, like, I love that kind of feeling of, like, what did you expect? And so, like, we kind of have a little mini version out here where it's just like, he said you might have to do that. And I don't know. I find that really funny and amusing and rewarding as opposed to, like, I, you know, giving it away early and then delivering it again later and being like, well, that's it. You know, you think it would be perfunctory, but somehow it's deeply, deeply satisfying. It's like promises made, promises kept, I guess, narratively. Jay, so what was your feeling on this and maybe the supernatural at large in this story? You know, we haven't talked a great deal about it beyond like the Popeye gum and this.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like the supernatural elements were all done really well in the sense that they were kept very weird. And I liked that. There was no point where we peel back and like hear the description of how the magical gum is made. Like there's no hit points for how long you last when you are chewing five gum or whatever. I really liked the way that was done. One of the things that I wanted to touch on, just based on like sort of what you guys were riffing on there, and I may have already lost the thought, so I'm backtracking just a little bit, but the like specifically the amount of information reveal is so tightly controlled in that area. Like that, what Valerie mentioned was most surprising to her was also most surprising for me. Like just the things that you tend to absorb as like something that just always gets done in a story like that. Like if you're going to open this door, you're going to close that door. Like just those types of innate details. And anytime you can turn them over in a way that's genuinely surprising is always good. And that really worked for me.
Nice. Milton, I mean, you can guess where I'm going to come here. Yeah. I'm curious what your take was on that scene in general, the supernatural at large, but also why don't we add on, what is your preference as a publisher? What when you're reading a story that's been submitted to you in the supernatural elements will make you kind of go, eh, and roll your eyes versus go, yeah, this is the thing.
Well, I love this part. I mean, to me, the last part of this story kind of took it to another level. It's kind of like I was sitting here enjoying this very good sweet potato pie. And just when I was getting to the last part of it, somebody came over and put some whipped cream on it. And I'm like, oh, snap. And that's kind of how I felt about the last part of the story, because I mean, I think the thing that made it so terrifying was that, like you said, when the character told him, look, if you have to do this stuff, you know, just go ahead and do it. And I felt like I was going to see these people resisting it and, you know, holding it back, but they couldn't. It was just so terrifying that everything that he said they were going to end up doing, they did it to the extreme. You know, I think Kurt did a really good job at describing that. You know, I mean, I'm terrified. You know, I was thinking that the woman was going to turn around, because I felt like she was almost like the, yep, I don't want to say the disposable character, but the character that
was set up that way. Yeah, she was set up to be like, she was set up to be your lesson, and then you don't get the lesson, it's a whole other thing.
Exactly. But she didn't, you know, she, because somebody stopped her from doing it like that. You know, I was thinking, so that all of that to me added to the tension and added to the terror of the whole scene. And, you know, because for me, one of the reasons I'm not a big horror reader is because nothing that I read is really scary to me or terrifying to me. And this is one of the few times I read something like that. I felt the emotion that was there. And I think Kurt did a really good job at describing that. As far as what I look for in magic in general, since I focus on sword and soul, I a lot of African cultures, a lot of the things that happen are connected to nature. There's power in nature. You know, there's a concept that everything contains a certain amount of energy. And when you acquire pieces of those things, you gain their energy. And that's one of the reasons you see a lot of African warriors from different cultures have different little things hanging on their body, because each thing they have on their body contains a certain amount of energy and it adds to your energy. And a lot of the potions and different things like that are basically, what you're basically doing is taking that energy from whatever plant or animal or whatever that you're using for, and you're adding it to your own. And you, it's like an accumulation of power in addition to where you sit in the hierarchy of things. If you're a chief, you automatically come from a lineage that's closer to the spirits, but then having these other items will actually give you even more power than that. So when you confront people on your own level. And I think the things that Kurt was working into this story are connected to that type, that aspect of sword and soul. And I enjoy that because, I mean, you grow up, you know, hearing the different things that you hear from different other cultures, but to see, and that's, and to me, that's one of the, I hate to talk about sword and soul so much, but that's one of the unifying things of everybody that writes sword and soul, is that connection between nature and spirituality, which is kind of common in most African cultures. And you see that, and whenever I see somebody write sword and soul, you're always going to see that because it's kind of like that common thing, you know. And Kurt did the same thing with addition, in addition to adding some other elements from other other aspects of sword and sorcery as well.
Right on. Okay, so I mean, I think we've had a really wonderful discussion here, and I've really enjoyed hearing all your thoughts. Why don't we do final thoughts? Valerie, is there anything else that just kind of popped in your head along the way here that, you know, maybe there wasn't quite a window for it you want to throw in here, or just sort of want to give it a big thumbs up? I don't know. What's your final thought for the night?
I'm just going to give a high five for the earlier on moment where the character's being told how much he's going to be paid and he does the math wrong.
It's literally
like four times, you know, whatever, and he gets it totally wrong, but then later he's able to just rattle off 3,400 whatever many years for the, and I'm like, yeah, he'd been playing us this entire time, thank you.
Yeah, that was a wonderful little detail. I love Nagara's
so good.
Feigned stupidity
story, so good.
Nice. Jay, what's your final thought for the night?
I don't think I have anything that we didn't get to, thankfully. This was a fantastic story, and it has been on this whole collection has been on my TBR for entirely too long. So I really appreciate the opportunity to like check that box. It was so good. I really enjoyed it.
Nice. And Milton, do you have any last thoughts for saying about this?
I enjoyed the story. I enjoyed the entire collection. I enjoyed that story. And I want to see these characters again. You know, I want to see them. I want to see them in another story, in another situation. I mean, since they're assassins, you know, there's plenty of scenarios where you can. And I just want to see them interact again and stuff. And because I do feel like there's a little tension between them. And I think that came out.
That's the thought I was trying to nail down earlier. That's the thought I was trying to nail down. They have history.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
their history is just sketched out around the edges. Like, you know that this story is like in the middle of that. There is stuff that happened before and there is stuff coming down the pike.
Exactly. So I'd love to see them in other stories and see more be revealed about their relationship.
Well, this is where as a publisher I get to go like, well, guess what? that's not all. You know, you'll get to see more adventures in Nagara and Laman. And no, but for real, you go, like I said, if you go to the campaign page and if you go to the campaign page and look at the cover of issue number 4, lo and behold, Laman and Nagara, with I guess some clues as to what their new adventure is in issue 4. I very explicitly said to Kirk, I'm like, dude, you got any more of these guys? I think they're great. I want more. Give me. So bless him. He's come through and written another fantastic tale with these two fellows. And I hope we get many more as well. And part of the reason I hope we get many more, just to get my closing thought beyond the salesmanship or whatever at all, and sort of coming back in a way to the final horror, right? These guys, you know, they're pretty hard. They're martial arts masters. They take brutal beatings multiple times in Patch's case throughout this whole thing. And you do get the feeling like, okay, they're hurt. You know, they're not like made of steel and vulnerable, but like they keep going, right? And so I think something that occasionally people mess up when they want to write tough guy characters, which is most of sword and sorcery, is never actually quite having them reach the point of being properly terrified or properly, you know, broken maybe is too strong a word, but certainly just like the toughness gives way for a little bit. You know, when I can't remember the proper name. I want to say the Iron Colossus or the Black Colossus. It's one of the early Conans where he encounters kind of a living statue, and there's just a scene that describes him hiding from it in this sort of like underground ruin or whatever on an island where the thing's stalking him, and he's already, you know, fought it a few times and it's going not his way. And I just, you know, the most memorable part of that whole story for me is Conan alone in the dark being like, holy crap, I'm dead. Like just, you know, realizing like if I don't figure out something more clever than like running at this thing, I'm dead. And that's a hell of a thing, especially with a character who has been so built up, right? And so in this, I greatly appreciated that we had these guys sufficiently, like, it did, and also it didn't make me, like, it didn't, like, deflate Conan. It's like, after that scene, I was like, oh, baby, and, like, never bought him again as a tough guy. It's like, you know, there's gradations, right? And so, and it made him more human, it made him more relatable, which is a big part of why I like sword and sorcery in general. In general, I find, you know, yeah, okay, they're pretty capable, and generally speaking, smart and clever characters. I mean, they're not, like, usually total inept boneheads, but usually Kugel the clever comes to mind, but you know, it's these guys, like, yeah, they're totally tough and cool, and they get one-liners and they're clever and they pull one, you know, tricks over people about their math abilities and so on, and then utterly humbled, and that little bit at the end that's kind of like almost feels like a weird, like, after a very late night 24-hour party, like, walk of shame situation with a bunch of them all just being like, so where are you going? Oh, you're going that way, okay, cool, well, we're going this way, so bye. You know, I'm just like, I love that because it just made them so human and so like, yeah, you know, they'd probably do better than I would have been. I might have looked over my shoulder, gotten eaten or whatever. And then off they go on the road again, off to another adventure. We get the nice, you know, bookmark situation where they got to wipe their ass. And just this feeling of like, there's more adventures ahead. And as you say, Jay, you know, there's also so many behind. We're somewhere in the middle of a grand saga. And so, yeah, I mean, the fun thing about being a publisher is I was like, make me more, please. I got to do that thing. So I won't give anything away. I'll just say, if you enjoyed the story, I think you'll really enjoy Kirk's new one with these two. And I hope he writes many more. All right. Thank you all so much for joining me for this discussion tonight, in particular this special crowdfund edition. It's a little reminder, folks, who are watching this, even if you're seeing the recording later, the crowdfund goes until 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on March 16th on the Friday night. Around 7 p.m. it'll start EST. We're going to be having our final end of crowdfund live stream telethon party, which is just going to be a lot of nonsense. Us all whooping it up, doing shots when we hit new, you know, levels or whatever of funding, or I won't make promises for others. And we actually already have scheduled a special role-playing game event. The people behind Black God's Kiss, the Jarell Lejeune TTRPG setting, one of them will be popping up as a guest game master, running a session with myself and whatever combination of staff and authors we end up having. I'm hoping Molly Tanzer will be able to make it so that she can play Jarell in the game after writing the pastiche. I hope the stars align for that, but whether or not they do, it's going to be a really good time, and I hope you join us, and I hope you pledge to support the campaign to help us keep making this magazine at the maximum level of quality we can, especially because part of that quality is paying creators as much as we are able, which is our very, actually all the remaining stretch goals are just alternating author and artist pay bumps. So, you know, do what you can, get on in there, give me all your money, whatever, it's a crowdfund, you know how these things go. Anyway, again, thank you all to my panel for joining us. Thank you to all of you in the audience for participating. Actually, I will say, someone has mentioned, speaking of Conan, a new short story by V. Castro about Belie was just released digitally today. That is true, and I look forward to reading that. But yeah, anyway, thanks everybody. Good night.
Good night.